Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Coming up, your letters, and there are a lot of them, and the five with Steph Curtis. This hour, yes, Mueller's investigation is complicated, but there are some things you should know. We started thinking about this show after we got a tweet from Gordon. It said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that the Mueller probe could be boiled down to one thing: Trump lied. I think it's much more complicated than that, and I was curious about what political scientist Samara Claire thought about it in an earlier show.
Part of what makes it so difficult is that we are getting intentional misrepresentations and lies about it. The point I was trying to make is that most people in their day-to-day life don't have the time to sit down and read every single article and every single word that's being published about these things. Quite understandably, we're taking care of our kids, we're cleaning our house, we're getting to work, we're doing all the things we need to do in the course of a day. It's not one of these issues that seems to impact people directly.
So today's show is not about the politics that surround the investigation and President Trump's response to it, although that may creep into the discussion. It's a show to cut through the political rhetoric and understand the facts as we can see them. This investigation's pretty opaque, but we've got two guests who I can hope will guide the conversation on that. It's also an opportunity for you to get some answers. So I'm looking for your genuine curiosity. What is confusing, confounding, or particularly interesting to you about what Robert Mueller is doing and why? What do you want to know about the consequences of the investigation? So genuine questions, curiosity, what's confusing, confounding, particularly interesting about what Robert Mueller is doing? And what do you want to know about the consequences of the investigation? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can also send your questions and your comments in via Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I. MPR. Chara Torres-Spelsi is one of our guests. She's a professor of law at Stetson and a fellow at the Brennan Center, and she joins us today from St. Petersburg, Florida. Chara, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me again.
Nick Ackerman is with us. He's a former federal prosecutor, a member of the Watergate prosecution team, currently a partner at Dorsey & Whitney, with us today from New York. Nick, I hear the question was whether you'd have to do jury duty today or not, so I'm glad you
did.
Well,
I did do jury duty. Oh. I was there Monday and excused, so I'm happy to be here today.
Hooray. Really good to have you here. So, Chara, there's been a lot of speculation about this Manafort information that emerged on Tuesday. This is also super confusing. So I was just going to lay out a couple of the things we appear to know. When Manafort was running the Trump campaign in 2016, it appears that he agreed to a meeting with a person who is believed to be part of Russian intelligence, and he gave that person some confidential information about the Trump campaign. Does all of that appear to be true?
Yes. So I am in the midst of writing a book on political corruption called Political Brand.
Oh, wow.
And I've had to dig into the Trump campaign and Russia. And it reminds me of Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury. It's unreliable narrators all the way down, including the president. And one of the narrators that I am struggling with the most is Paul Manafort. It looks like he was cooperating with the special counsel's office for a few minutes there, but now the special counsel has come back and is telling the judge in his case that actually Mr. Manafort continued to lie to the special counsel, and one of the lies that he allegedly made was about giving this polling information to a foreign national while he was Trump's campaign manager.
Nick, will you often find unreliable narrators, as Chara puts it, in these kinds of investigations into potential corruption? Is Manafort unusual in the way that he's turned up in this investigation?
No, not at all. But I think that really understand what's going on here, you have to back up a bit and look at the big picture. What is Mueller looking at? And I think for the view, the listeners to really understand this, you have to put it into four buckets. And two of those have already been indicted on with respect to Russian operatives that came out in the last year. The first being an indictment that was handed down on February 16th of last year against 13 Russian operatives, three companies, that all related to the use of data to go in and micro-target voters. That's where this whole Manafort thing comes in with respect to individual, you know, the polling list that he used. That was used to go right in and direct information at voters, particularly Hillary Clinton voters, to suppress them, to keep them from voting.
So if I might, now, Nick, just for a minute, because I think this is important and it's confusing. What we're saying here is that Paul Manafort, of course, had very important information about the Trump campaign, which was their interior polling data. This is highly confidential for campaigns. And it appears that he gave it to this person connected to the Kremlin, and that information could be used to go after specific voters on social media. Is that right?
That's right. And there's no other legitimate use for it. I mean, there's no reason why any Russian would ever want that kind of information. The second bucket here has to do with the break-in to the Democratic National Committee and the theft of emails and documents that were used during the campaign, which has been charged also as a conspiracy, the object of which was not only to break into the Democratic National Committee, but also to stage and release the information that was taken. The third bucket that everybody has heard about is this obstruction of justice area, which really is kind of the tail wagging the dog in the sense that it's really, you don't charge obstruction of justice unless you really show an underlying crime, just like in Watergate, where there was no charge of obstruction of justice, but for the fact that there was a break-in into the Watergate office of the Democratic National Committee, and it was used basically to show motive and why people were obstructing justice. So you put that aside. I mean, the real substantive crimes are the one relating to social media, the other relating to the break-in at the Democratic National Committee. And the fourth area that is out there that we haven't heard much about relates to this Maria Butina, who has recently pled guilty and cooperating. And there are press reports that money may have been sent through the NRA, the National Rifle Association, to go to the Trump campaign from Russia. We don't know much about that other than there have been press reports on that. So I think the best way for listeners to look at all of these various facts that come out is to put them into the pigeonholes that you've got, these four pigeonholes, the social media, the break-in at the Democratic National Committee, the obstruction of justice, and this area relating to Maria Butina, the Russian spy who's pled guilty.
That's helpful. A call here from Chris in Windermere, Florida. Hi, Chris. What are you interested in?
Well, I'm interested in this latest piece of news about Paul Manafort revealing polling data and how that might fit into these four different buckets that the gentleman is talking about. And also, just curious, this Maria, I can't pronounce her last name.
Butina,
yeah. Yeah. Is she a U.S. citizen, or how is it that she is pleading guilty? Most of these Russian defendants, I thought, just kind of left the country or couldn't be prosecuted. So I'm curious about that.
I'm coming back to that. Chara, to the first question about how this latest news on Manafort would fit in, given what we've just heard from Nick about the four different pigeonholes here, how does it fit into the overall investigation into corruption?
So
So one of the things that the special counsel was charged with investigating was Russian interference in the 2016 election. And as Nick accurately portrayed, the special counsel has charged multiple Russians with both the hacking of the DNC and with this social media disinformation campaign. And one of the things that I think a lot of us have been waiting for is, were there any Americans who helped the Russians? Were there any American Confederates? And this latest revelation from Manafort's attorneys, because they couldn't redact a document properly, indicates that perhaps Manafort may be the first American Confederate who we've found in this investigation. He may not be the only one, but that is what the special counsel is looking at. He's looking for conspiracy. Now, for weird reasons I don't quite understand, in the media, this has become collusion. That's the word. It's a conspiracy. And so one of the things that I'm desperate to find out from the special counsel in the coming months is, were there any Americans involved?
What we don't know, Chara, is whether, because Mueller has not presented the report and there haven't been more mistakes on redaction, we don't know if they know whether the president knew what Manafort was doing, right? We don't know that yet.
Yeah, we're back to the old Watergate question. What did the president know and when did he know it?
Nick, weigh in.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's plenty of indicia out there that he probably did know, but we don't have the actual evidence at this point. We're really waiting for the next round of indictments. If you take these two Russian indictments that came out last year, I think that what Mueller is investigating in particular is filling in the conspirators on the American side for each indictment. That's what we're looking at. When we hear all of this reporting about Roger Stone, for example, and that all really relates to the staging and release of the documents and emails that were stolen from the Democratic National Committee. When we hear about Paul Manafort and passing on polling information to the Russians, that all relates to the micro-targeting of voters in specific districts to suppress the vote. So, I mean, you can take all of this news, which I can understand can get very confusing to people, but that all fits into one of these four buckets in one way or the other.
Call here from Kat in St. Paul. Hi, Kat. Appreciate you waiting. What are you interested in here?
Absolutely. So we've heard from the president's team that he feels that he can pardon himself, but his pardonabilities only pertain to federal crimes. What's the Mueller investigation's connection to the state and local prosecutions that are happening or may be happening?
Nick, to you, because you're in New York, where the state has looked into this. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you look at some of these cooperation agreements, for example, the Flynn cooperation agreement, he is obligated not only to reveal everything he knows to the federal government, meaning the Mueller team, but also to any state or local investigations that Mueller directs him to cooperate with. In addition, Mueller pretty much made Manafort's plea pardon proof by making him allocute, meaning to admit to all of the crimes he committed in minute detail with a hugely a large statement of facts that he had to file in court, as well as his statement before the judge in court, such that a state attorney general in New York or Virginia could take those statements and basically bring similar charges for money laundering and tax evasion against Manafort in those two states. I mean, thirdly, I think there's a real issue as to the pardon and, first of all, Trump's ability to pardon himself or his co-conspirators. I think that based on the Constitution, his duty is to faithfully execute the laws and to do so when he has a conflict of interest, if in fact he's trying to get to exonerate people who might turn against him and testify. I think there's a real issue that has never been decided before by the Supreme Court, whether or not the pardon power would apply under those circumstances. I mean, since the Constitution has been written, there is an enormous body of law that relates to conflict of interest, the idea that an individual cannot judge his own case. And I think there's a good chance that Trump's use of the pardon in certain circumstances might not be upheld by the courts.
This is a show, if you've just gotten in on it, to try to penetrate the veil of secrecy and confusion that surrounds what Robert Mueller is doing. And that secrecy is for a purpose. We understand that. But as journalists and Americans and voters, we'd like to know as much about it as we can. So we've invited Chara Torres-Spelsey with us from the Brennan Center and Stetson University College of Law, and Nick Ackerman, a former federal prosecutor, currently a partner at Dorsey and Whitney with experience on the Watergate prosecution team, to help us draw some information from what we know so far, right? From this error this week of not fully redacting information from Manafort's team of lawyers, some of the other reporting that has gone on to try to understand what's happening with this and what it means in the larger sense for the country. So asking you this morning for the things that you're curious about, you're confused about, you're wondering about the next steps. What happens if this, and this happens? We're taking your calls on that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at @CarrieMPR. Chara, there is some puzzlement about why the language of the platform of the Republican Party convention was altered on Ukrainian-Russian policy. So I looked back at some of the reporting in July of 2016 on this. This also kind of goes to what was going on with Manafort. And the LA Times wrote this about it. The platform written at the GOP convention in Cleveland this week eliminated references to arming Ukraine in its fight with Russia, which seized the Crimean Peninsula in 2014 and has supported separatists in eastern Ukraine. Many in the party's foreign policy establishment are outraged. This seems important, but why is it important, potentially?
Potentially, it's part of a quid pro quo between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. So, and this, let me back up. So one of our unreliable narrators here is the current president, mm-hmm. which is, a big claim to make, but I do not make it lightly. The reason I call him an unreliable narrator is he has repeatedly said things that were either misleading or lies. Three that come into play here is he claimed that he was a self-financed candidate. That was partially true, but he only gave his campaign 20% of the funds that it had, which means that 80% of the money in his campaign was from other people's money. He claimed he had no business in Russia. We now know that he was negotiating for the construction of Trump Tower Moscow between October of 2015 and June of 2016, which is the presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. And moreover, he claimed that his campaign had no contacts with Russians. And now we know that that is an utter lie. And so that bundle of lies makes it very difficult to see the quid pro quo. If you actually believe him that he has no business in Russia, then the change in the GOP platform seems like it might be above board. It may be just a change of opinion of the Republicans on the relationship between Ukraine and Russia. Mm-hmm. You add in the Trump Tower Moscow deal, it's possible that that was quid pro quo, which is corruption, this for that in Latin.
Nick, do you look at the change that was made and the concerns that were expressed by other members of the Republican Party at that convention and see something that might be significant or somewhat coincidental?
No, not at all coincidental. I mean, I totally agree. This was a quid pro quo, and it's part of a pattern. You've got to put it in the context of all of the evidence. I mean, essentially, I think the bottom line is that in return for help during the campaign that the Russians gave the Trump campaign, the quid pro quo was that when elected, Trump would basically get rid of the sanctions that were imposed on Russia for its invasion into Crimea. Now, what happened was this all got mucked up when Obama decided in his final days to impose additional sanctions on Russia, which led to Michael Flynn lying to the FBI about his conversation with the Russian ambassador. And if you look closely at his statement of offense that he made at the time, he admitted to the materiality of his lie. And materiality is a critical element of a false statement to the FBI. And if you look at the statement of offense, it says that his statement was had a material impact on the FBI's ongoing investigation into the existence of any links or coordination between individuals associated with the campaign and Russia's efforts to interfere with the 2016 presidential election. So he's lying about a statement he made to the Russian ambassador about sanctions, and it all relates to this idea that it's important and material to the coordination between the campaign and the Russian government, all of which says to me that what he's going to be able to testify to is that there was a quid pro quo promise. There was a whole series of meetings right after Obama imposed those sanctions. And you've got a lot of information coming out of that to the point where Flynn's assistant basically wrote an email saying, and I quote, "If there's a tit-for-tat escalation, Trump will have difficulty improving relations with Russia, which has just thrown USA election to him," close quote. So they knew that they had to deliver on this promise because the Russian government had delivered to the Trump campaign. And so I think what you're going to find is that Flynn is going to testify to those facts at some point, which is why when he went for his sentencing, the sentencing judge was disturbed over his conduct. And it wasn't because of conduct that was out there that we knew about. The judge had material in camera that was sealed as to exactly what Flynn's role was. And when he talked about Flynn's role bordering on treason or being treasonous, this is what he was talking about.
Okay, that explains something I was confused about. Steven says on Twitter, Chara, given how shocking the news is every day, is the strategy to desensitize until nothing is shocking anymore? And this goes to some of the things that President Trump has been saying, as you noted. It seems this is all about norms. Feeling naive, assumed we had laws, but it now seems like our government is more heavily weighted toward norms. Does the report matter? Chara?
I think the report matters a great deal, and I think it's very important that it become public so that the American voter can consider it when they make their next choice of president. I think it will be important for it to be public so that the Congress can possibly use their constitutional role in disciplining a out-of-control president.
Chara, you mentioned again the unreliable narrator part of this that the president has played. I want to play something that the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, said about this when he was asked in late December about the president's attempts to delegitimize the investigation. Here's what Rudy Giuliani said to that.
He is a person with a First Amendment right to defend himself, First Amendment right to express his opinion. And as a president, it's even more important that he express his opinion because these kinds of allegations can do damage to the country, not just to the particular president. And if he believes he's innocent, and he is innocent, he should speak out.
Is that fair, Chara?
Of course, every American has a First Amendment right. But in the context of these ongoing investigations. And it's not just the special counsel's investigation. He's also being potentially investigated by the Southern District of New York and the AUSAs there. I mean, one of the things that is remarkable for someone who studies campaign finance like I do is the campaign finance laws are actually being enforced in this case. So, for example, Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, has pled guilty to two campaign finance violations. One is basically an excessive campaign finance donation, and the other is facilitating illegal corporate contributions. And in his allocution with his sentencing judge, he said that I did these crimes at the behest of the current president. And so there is a possibility that we have an unindicted co-conspirator sitting in the White House. I mean, this could not be more serious.
Call here from Al in Bloomington, Minnesota. Al, what are you thinking about? Hi.
Well, I guess what I think a lot of people are getting tired of all the inside baseball that the trial lawyers bring up on all these issues, because it's been almost 2 years. Why don't they just come out and tell us if Trump had anything to do with it? It seems to me that the longer it goes, the more they're searching for an angle.
Nick and Chara, think about that while we get a look at the latest news. But consider, because I think we need to develop that discussion a little more here. If you can't wrap an investigation in a couple years, what does it say about the investigation itself? That's one of the questions. Nick, that question about you've had 2 years, Robert Mueller. If there was anything there, you would have found it. What's the answer to that?
Well, let me give you a couple answers here. First of all, there's talk about a report. What a prosecutor does normally is to hand down indictments and charge people with crimes. So it's unclear whether there is going to be a report or whether there will be a report, but I certainly believe there's going to be additional indictments. Secondly, I think what people have to understand, and I can kind of understand the frustration that this has gone on for a while, but this a criminal investigation like this that spans, you know, not just the United States, but Russia and other countries around the world where they're gathering evidence and documents takes a long time. 2 years is not a very long time for this kind of a complicated investigation, where already there have been 100-plus charges brought against people, where you've got three people who have pled guilty, Rick Gates, the deputy campaign manager, Michael Cohen, the president's personal lawyer, and Michael Flynn, the national security advisor, not to mention that Paul Manafort has been convicted of a whole series of serious felonies. But the problem is, I think it's because people watch too much television that they think these criminal investigations, you know, happen quickly, that we're all attuned to the 24-hour news cycle. A criminal investigation doesn't work that way. You go to one piece of evidence, it leads you to another piece of evidence. This is a type of investigation that if it occurred quickly and ended quickly, you'd have to question the validity of it. It just doesn't work that way in the real world of conducting criminal investigations. What Mueller has to do is put together evidence. If he's going to indict people, you know, he's not going to just go by the standard of a grand jury indictment that there be probable cause that somebody committed a crime. He's looking, because of the high visibility of this case, to put together evidence to make certain that anybody that he does indict can be convicted beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a standard a jury will have to follow if any indictment does come down and there is a trial. So there's a lot of progress made in these 2 years. I mean, it's quite phenomenal how much progress has been made, the number of indictments that have come out, the spread of this investigation into the Southern District of New York. In fact, the indictment the other day of this Natalia Veselovich-Knaya, who was the Russian lawyer at the Trump Tower meeting, is extremely significant to this investigation. What is really of interest here is that if you read through this indictment, what she did was she fabricated a document to be used in a civil case in the Southern District of New York. But the government's proof is laid out in detail here, which are emails that she authored, that she went back and forth between the chief prosecutor of the Russian Federation and herself fabricating this document. So the question you have to ask is, how did they get these emails? You know she didn't turn them over. You know that Mueller has no subpoena power in Russia. So somebody in our government is clever enough to be able to get those emails in 2014. You have to assume that they're also getting emails straight up through the time of the Trump Tower meeting.
Wow.
And once you start getting that kind of evidence and you start putting it together and talking to people and trying to corroborate it, corroborate your cooperating witnesses, this is not easy. In fact, I mean, it's absolutely amazing the kind of evidence that Mueller has put together up to this point.
All right.
Chara, so it takes time.
Chara, question here from Ryan, who says, what are the chances any member of the Trump family actually does prison time if found guilty of crimes? Also, is there an indication that the vice president, Mike Pence, is involved at all in the conspiracies?
Well, I guess a few things. One, we don't have any charges against any member of the Trump family. And similarly, there are no charges against the vice president. And the question of what would happen if, Don Jr., for example, were charged with a crime, I think this gets to a point that Nick was talking about earlier. We have had presidents pardon members of their family before. I think President Clinton, if I'm not mistaken, pardoned his half-brother Roger. And so we've had that before. What we haven't had is a pardon that implicates the president's own liability and criminal exposure. And so it is possible that this will get litigated if that's the way it unfolds, that you have a member of the Trump family charged with a crime, you have a presidential pardon that excuses that crime, and then you get litigation about the appropriateness of such a pardon.
Got it. Here's Liz on Twitter, Chara. She says, good to wrangle all of this information together. Thank you. Question, why did a group of U.S. Congress members go to Russia last summer? I've been curious and haven't heard why they went and the outcome. Is there anything necessarily nefarious about a delegation of U.S. members of Congress going over to Russia?
Under normal circumstances, probably not.
Uh-huh.
That we're in normal circumstances anymore. I think this is going to be a treasure trove for historians. And I think one of the things that will come out in the wash eventually is who was acting in America's best interest and who wasn't. And there are going to be heroes. Like, for example, there was this Australian diplomat in a bar in London, and he overhears George Papadopoulos bragging about the Russians having dirt on Hillary Clinton. And he does the honorable thing, and he turns that over to the American authorities. And I think he will be remembered as one of the heroes of this story.
It's super interesting.
And not going to come out so positively.
Huh. Okay, Nick, call for you here from Marie in Stillwater. Hi, Marie. What do you want to know?
Well, I was just going to point out, I know Nick is far more familiar with the legal process than I am, and I know we need to be patient, but I do think it's worth pointing out that Congress has a role to play in helping the public understand, and so far to date, they have not done a very good job at increasing transparency. And we even have Devin Nunes, who is the chair of intelligence in the House, doing some very unusual and curious things. And that kind of leads me to my question, which is, I thought I had read that the RNC was hacked, and yet nothing was released. And I also find it curious the behavior of some of these Republican congressmen and women in this whole thing. Is it possible that there is compromise or information that's guiding some of their behavior and decisions?
Nick?
We don't know that. Anything's possible, of course. I mean, I think the best thing I can do is just draw the parallel to the Watergate situation, where you had the Democrats controlling both houses of Congress, and you had the Senate Select Committee actually conducting an open hearing where witnesses were called, which I got to tell you interfered somewhat with our investigation, our criminal investigation, because all this stuff was coming out. But it was a much different situation because the narrative as to what happened was all out there in the public by June, July of 1973. And even with that, I might add, Nixon didn't resign from the presidency until August of 1974. But it was a much different situation because the public knew the basic narrative very early on. They knew that the Republican organization that was known as CREEP, the Committee to Reelect the President, had basically been behind the break-in to the Democratic National Committee, and they knew from John Dean's testimony, who was the counsel to the President, his testimony that the President and his chief advisors were all involved in the obstruction and the cover-up. So it's a lot different now, where we're getting bits and pieces through various indictments that have come out, through various guilty pleas, because lawyers screw up and don't redact information properly, happened with Manafort.
Right.
Yeah. So what you point out is 100% correct. And what makes it even worse is you actually had Republicans on this House committee who were intentionally trying to muck this all up and obstruct what was going on and keep the public from knowing.
Nick, thank you so much for spending the hour with us and bringing so much clarity and light to this. Really grateful for the time. I hope you'll come back.
Sure. Love to be here.
I'm going to grab one last call here for Chara to Peter in Minneapolis. Peter, I think you're asking a good question here. What do you want to know from Chara?
Yes, what I'm curious about is, more on the Manafort sharing information with the Russians and things like that. Take the Russians out of it and say Mr. Manafort shared that with an American group, and then they did the Facebook targeting and things like that. Would there have been any issue there, or is this just, kind of because the Russians were involved?
So you mean, what if it was an American social media organization that was involved in hacking, Peter?
Not necessarily the hacking, but Mr. Manafort shared information with the Russian operative,
yeah.
Or and then the Russians, did a lot of social media, whatever we want to call it. But if that was done by just Americans on their own,
okay,
would there have been any issue?
What do you think, Chara?
So the part of why all of this is a crime is foreign nationals are not allowed to spend money in an American election. And so the reason that the social media campaign, including the Facebook ads, breaks the law is because some of those ads were purchased using rubles by Russian nationals. And it's the Russian nationals buying political ads during an American election that is illegal. So you're right. If Paul Manafort was giving information to a domestic group, a domestic group would be covered by the First Amendment, and they could spend as they want, so long as it's within the normal confines of campaign finance law. But a Russian national, basically, there's nothing that they can do in terms of buying political ads that is legal in the United States.
Chara, given what Nick said about the development of so much information during this period of the Mueller investigation, there's been a lot of speculation that it's coming to a culmination in 2019. Can we not assume that?
We don't know. I think the fairest thing we can say is that Mueller has been meticulous and very careful, and he hasn't leaked a thing. And so whether he's ending this year or ending next year or 3 years from now, I think we can have confidence in the quality of his workmanship in, you know, drilling down on leads, finding the documentary evidence that proves the crime. I mean, one of the things he did most recently is he got Michael Cohen, the president's former lawyer, to confess to lying to Congress about the Trump Tower Moscow deals. Mm-hmm. And that shows two things. One, he knows a lot about what happened in 2016, and he knows who's lied about it to his prosecutors and the FBI in the interim.
And when you say he, you mean Mueller, not Cohen.
Correct. Correct.
And you're saying he's leveraging the knowledge that he has against some of these people that he's indicted and working out deals with.
Exactly. A lot of the first plea deals have been lying to the FBI. That's what Flynn pled to. I think that's what Papadopoulos pled to. So he knows when you're lying, and he's made a point of prosecuting that as well.
Just like Santa Claus. He knows if you've been good or bad, and he's coming after you, right?
Indeed.
Chara, good to have you on the show. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to have you weigh in, and I hope you'll be back.
Of course. Thank you.
Chara Torres-Spelsi with us. She's a Brennan Center Fellow and a professor of law at Stetson University College of Law.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.